Thank you. You may be seated. So with all the stuff going on in January, it's been almost a month since we left off on the beginning of 1 Corinthians. So we'll take just a quick minute to remember what was in how the letter began. After the introduction, which you remember, Paul like says all these wonderful things about how the Corinthians have everything they need to live just full Christian lives, but he actually, like in the introduction, he actually said nothing good about them. after that introduction, he started by commenting on the divisions in the church. But as we traced where Paul went with that thought, we saw that the divisions were not the real problem, but were a symptom of the real problem, and that the real problem was that the Corinthians, although they had come to faith, still valued and still trusted in human abilities. Okay? Now that would lead to all kinds of wrong ideas about a bunch of different topics that Paul will address later in the letter, but it also threatened to make the gospel ineffective in transforming their lives, okay? Trying to handle the gospel truth with human wisdom, which is what they were doing, Paul said will actually rob the cross of its power. And then what follows is a couple of chapters, basically through chapter 4, of contrast between human wisdom and power and God's wisdom and power. Okay, so through chapter 1 and into the start of chapter 2, the first five verses of chapter 2, Paul first deals with the negative side, looking at human wisdom, and specifically how the cross exposes human wisdom and power to be nothing more than weakness and folly. But then from chapter 2, verse 6, he'll cover the positive side, looking at how God's wisdom works out, God's wisdom and God's power work out in the church. So this week, we're looking at chapter 1, verses 18 through 25, where the central idea is that human wisdom is shown to be foolishness by the revelation of God's wisdom, which, when it appears, appears as abject foolishness. Okay? And then the next 2 weeks, we'll look at verses 26 through the end of chapter 1 and into the first five verses of chapter 2, where we'll have two examples of how that works. First of all, in the lives of the Corinthians themselves, and then second, after that, in the life of Paul. So the plan this morning is to read through the text and then just to go back through it, kind of explaining and elaborating. So this is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, from verse 18 to verse 25. And because it connects, I'll throw out the last verse of what we read before. The last section ended, "For the Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with words of human wisdom," and then the key piece from last week, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate." Where is the wise man? Where's the scholar? Where's the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs, and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. The word of God for the people of God. So it begins, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. So just a quick note on this, the categories here, those who are perishing and those who are being saved, should not be taken to mean those who will ultimately be saved or lost in the eternal foreknowledge of God. Okay? This is not the elect and the non-elect. I'm not saying that doesn't appear in other places of the Bible, because it very clearly does. It's not what these words are talking about, okay? The form of the verb here, the way that the Greek present tense works, is that this is referring not to like end results, but to processes that are now still playing out. So that here, the present tense of those who are perishing doesn't mean those who will eventually perish. It means those who are, it just means those who aren't now following the Lord. If someone isn't now made the decision to get on this other path and follow Jesus on this way, then by default, he's still on this road that leads to destruction. Okay? The one who is today perishing could easily be among those who are saved tomorrow. Okay? So here, sometimes people take this verse to mean that if we preach the cross and somebody says that makes no sense at all, then it's a sign that they're not elect. Okay? That is not at all what Paul is saying here. What he's saying here is that unless you experience the power of the cross, unless you've experienced that saving intervention, then there's no making sense of the cross. That the cross, there's nothing there for your head to sort out. Either you've experienced it and you know without understanding that this is the power of God, or you look at it and you say, what is it you guys believe? Okay? He's saying that it's not a matter of things that people can understand. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Okay? This is from the passage in Isaiah 29 that we opened the service with. And this quote is Paul putting it in as just a reminder that God has always, throughout the Old Testament, he has always promised that in the day of judgment, because that's what the Isaiah 29 looks at, the final day of judgment, God has always promised that in the day of judgment, he will expose all human pride to be empty. Right? When people stand before God in the day of judgment, all the things that they prided themselves in, all the things they trusted in, will be exposed to be utterly worthless. And more than worthless, they will be an embarrassment because people trusted in them. Okay? Back there in Isaiah, God was speaking to those who gave him lip service, but whose hearts were far from him. They claimed to trust the Lord, but they in fact trusted in their own understanding and in their own abilities. And there, Isaiah promised that in the day of judgment, that human wisdom and that human ability would not just fail to save them, but it would actually be put to shame. That they would be ashamed of themselves for what they had trusted in. And so here, with this quote, by bringing in this quote, what Paul is saying is that that future day of judgment has actually taken place at the cross. Okay? And this is an idea that pops up in the New Testament over and over and over again, if you know the Old Testament well enough to make sense of those quotes. Okay? The idea is that the day of judgment has not just been demonstrated or prefigured, but it's actually been pre-experienced, pre-enacted in the cross, that in the moment of the cross, the final day of judgment has broken in our current age, okay? In such a way that most of the world can utterly ignore it. In the cross, the promised salvation has come together with the exposing as nothing all those things that people trust in. But it happened in such a way that those who are still looking for answers that make sense to the human way of thinking miss it. Then he explains how it is that the cross has exposed human wisdom to be empty. He takes these rhetorical questions. Where is the wise man? Where's the scholar? Where's the philosopher of this age? Right? And the answer expected all of them is not here. Okay? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Because it didn't get them into the church. It didn't bring them back to God. Okay? And then he explains that. He says, for since in the wisdom of God, right, when God planned out a way, his wisdom dictated a way, for since in the wisdom of God, the world, through its wisdom, did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Right? So this is saying that God, when he chose to reveal himself, which brings about reconciliation and salvation and redemption and restoration, when God chose to reveal himself, in his wisdom, he decided to reveal himself and save the world in a particular way. God's wisdom looked at all the ways you can skin a cat, and he said, this is the way it's going to be done. This particular way is what Paul calls the foolishness of what was preached. Right? Because the gospel describes how God has saved the world. Now, the original, in the Greek, it literally says the foolishness of preaching. Right? And you may know that a lot of the older translations say that here, by the foolishness of preaching. Okay? But the Greek word translated preaching can mean both the act of preaching, like our modern word preaching, but it can also mean the thing that was actually preached. Okay? Which our English word doesn't usually point to that. Okay? Which is why the NIV chooses to say the foolishness of what was preached. And that's good. Okay? It is likely that Paul would say that the act of preaching is also foolishness. And he kind of alludes to that, and he speaks about that in other passages. Okay? That simply standing up and declaring this thing that makes no sense is not a way to go about changing human hearts. Okay? But here, the primary sense of what Paul is saying is definitely what was preached. Namely, that the humiliation, universal rejection, and degradation, utter degradation, of God's chosen servant is the demonstration of the power and wisdom of God. That's the foolishness. Human ideas of wisdom and human ideas of power are offended at that message and turn away in disgust. Both Jews and Greeks have had a very high view of humanity. Okay? Nowadays, people kind of, yeah, we have this sense that there's this human dignity thing, but most people who really stop and think and about it decide that humans, you know, we're just really animals like any other animal, and there's nothing about us that, I mean, we pride ourselves, but really we're the same as frogs and tigers and dogs and bugs and stuff, and, you know, who made us any better, right? That was not, okay, the Jews and Greeks both knew better than we do. They both had a very, very high view of what a person should be, of what it was to be human. And while they differed from one another, the Jew and Greek versions of that, Jesus hanging on the cross was the dead opposite of both of them. And so all those who have any respect at all for what a human ought to be turn in disgust from what God does and what Jesus does, from what God chooses and what Jesus chooses. But that stumbling block of disgrace actually accomplishes the rescue of the human race. Follow the sentence. At the cross, God restores the human race to real humanity by the dehumanization of the one human who was truly human. And the humanists, right, who believe in humanity, turn away in disgust at the degradation of a human. I have a story that I was unsure where to put in the sermon. I'm going to stick it in here. Three men walk into a restaurant. Starts like a joke, right? Halfway through the meal, the owner comes by to greet them and makes them an offer. A lot of important people come through my restaurant. If any of you can impress me, your meal is free. And this is the kind of place where the meal was, you know, this is a bit of an offer. The first was a president of a nearby university. He immediately began to point around the room. He identified at least a dozen different species of wood in the furniture and commented on the characteristics of each. He pointed out three bottles of wine on the neighboring table and gave short histories of the three wineries, their regions, and which vintages were best known of theirs. He then proceeded to point out details of the building's architecture and decor, placing each element in its own proper historical context, and then using the building's history as kind of a guidebook or a tour of how the city itself had developed over 300 years of history. He was just at the point of noticing the host's awkward posture and was going to explain all of the smaller muscle groups of the backs and hips when the second man, the CEO of a major corporation, cut him off. "I'm not so wordy as my friend here," he said, "but with one phone call, I can get your business loan recalled, your lease canceled, your health inspection revoked, and a scathing review in every paper tomorrow." The host said, "Yes, I've seen many of your types come through." Then looking at the third man, he said, "What about you?" The third didn't say anything, but took a knife off the table, slit his own throat, and died. Some people laugh at that. I imagine other people find it inappropriate. There are churches where I would get a lot of feedback afterwards that that is not appropriate for a sermon. Some people I know, with that turn of the story and that sudden sharp image, right, would feel a real sudden deep revulsion, a feeling like you wish that you hadn't heard that, right? A feeling like you wish you could get that out of your head, but you can't, okay? That's the feeling that we need to hold on to. And honestly, I'm a little bit disappointed that the story didn't work. You laughed, right? We're so used to the idea of the cross that it's lost all of its offense. The picture of Christ dying, humiliated and degraded, is offensive and outrageous. But even when we say that, I think usually we misunderstand how it actually worked, okay? When we talk about the offense and the outrage of the cross, it is not the outrage that someone would do that to him. Right? This is where the Passion of the Christ, right, the Mel Gibson, really gets it wrong. You watch that, and Jesus is the victim. And you're like, how could the world do that to him? That's not the outrage of the cross in the ancient world. The outrage is that he would allow himself to be degraded. Jesus claims to be the ideal man, but then he lets his humanity, that thing which we are supposed to cherish and respect and protect, He allows, willingly allows, his humanity to be dragged through the mud in the worst possible way so that anyone who has any respect for what it means to be human is disgusted and turns away and says, we will have nothing to do with that. But Paul says that here, there are few who were so lost, so weak, and degraded themselves as to not look away from the cross. And for them, a wisdom and power are released that transforms them, restoring them to God and to the true humanity that only flows from him. And in this way, the best of humanity, everything that it means to be human, the best that we have to offer, fails to find the restoration of their humanity in God, so that their supposed wisdom and power are demonstrated to be worthless. And so, the wise and the powerful remaining on the outside, saying, spare me that nonsense. So why does humanity turn away from the cross in disgust? Because, like the PhD and the CEO, we naturally believe that our value lies in our ability to understand and our ability to get things done. We think a person is worthwhile if they have insight and ability. The world sees Jesus on the cross and can only conclude that he had no insight and no ability. If he did, he wouldn't end up there. Now, these are not universal, rigid categories. Okay, this is not two groups of people. It's two principles. But Paul makes a valid generalization that Greeks respect insight and understanding, and the Jews respect power. He continues, Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Gentiles, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. When he says that Jews require miraculous signs, the idea of a miracle there isn't breaking the laws of physics, which therefore proves the reality of the supernatural. Which is, that's how we conceive, that's what a miracle is in our kind of our modern mindset. We think of a miracle as, you know, something that we can't explain, therefore there has to be a God. Okay? That's not at all how the word is functioning here. The real root idea here is simply power. Okay? Another biblical word for a miracle is wonder. And the word wonder isn't, oh, I can't understand this. It's awe at raw power. God's ability to reach into the world and change things. Okay? It's not about supernatural, it's about power. The quintessential or paradigmatic work of power in the Old Testament is the Exodus. And again, the idea behind the plagues and the Red Sea is not that these things are unexplainable by physical laws, right? And honestly, when different scientists go through and they study about, you know what, like if there was this kind of a landslide up in lower Egypt, it would have caused this red earth to fall into the sea and that would have killed all the fish and that would have made the frogs come out and blah, blah. When there are explanations of that, that shouldn't bother us at all. The fact that all those things happened exactly when they did with exactly the results that they had, that's the power of God, whether it breaks any laws of physics or not. Okay? Again, it's not that the plagues of the Red Sea break physical laws, it's that God steps forth in real, tangible power to get something done. Okay? That's what the Jews respected. Okay? And again, we're not talking about the Jews as though suddenly we have this insight into what makes a people a people. No. This is Paul generalizing the Jews that Paul here generalizes, know that part of the degradation of humanity, part of what's wrong with us, is our weakness, our inability. And so they know that rescue, restoration, redemption, and deliverance will mean the people of God rising up in strength when God moves on their behalf. And then they're told to look at the cross. Do you see strength or do you see weakness? They're waiting for an Alexander the Great, a Judas Maccabee, a Julius Caesar. And when God offers them Jesus dying on the cross, they say, "That's disgusting. Take that away." And those he generalizes as Greeks require wisdom. That way of looking at the world that makes sense, that allows someone to say, "Ah, I understand what's really going on." There are a lot of us that aren't impressed by the power broker or the entrepreneur, but by that guy that writes the book that is just brilliant, or who is able to explain what's really going on in the world today with depth and genuine insight, or the woman whose TED Talk pulls together a dozen different things that you sort of had a sense of, but you could never really pull together yourself, right? These, quote, Greeks know that part of the degradation of humanity is our confusion, our utter inability to make sense of our lives or the world around us. And so we understand instinctively that when humanity is restored to wholeness, the people of God will rise up in wisdom, understanding the world, understanding life, understanding themselves, knowing what the problem is and what needs to be done about it. And they're told to look at the cross. Does God's plan look wise or foolish? They're waiting for a Socrates or a Cicero or a Buddha who says, "Here's the way of peace and wholeness." And God shows them Jesus dying on the cross. And they say, "That's disgusting. Take that away." What is it the world really respects? The PhD and the CEO. The people who really understand what we don't, and the people who really take on huge problems and get it done. If we were to imagine someone who could save us and lift humanity up out of all our problems, what's all the political discourse today about? How do we fix this mess? And the world wants a Trump on one side or a Hillary on the other. They look to Warren Buffett or Bill Gates. They think an Einstein or a General MacArthur could really get something done around here. And God offers us Jesus, who doesn't even have the sense to say, "What, do I look like a king?" when he stands in front of Pilate. How easy would it have been to get out of the cross? God shows us Jesus, who doesn't even have the power to lead his followers against a few guards that come to arrest him. And yet the Corinthians and we know that this disgusting display of weakness and folly that Jesus intentionally chooses is in fact the wisdom and power of God breaking into the world to restore us to himself, and in the restoration to himself, to restore us to what humanity is truly supposed to be. If the Corinthians understand that, and some of them don't, and if we understand that, and to the full, we don't, how can they or we ever look at anything the same again? That's what Paul is really after here. A real understanding of the cross is a nuclear missile at the foundation of everything you think you know. And we don't allow that to happen because it's frightening. It's scary. Nobody wants their foundations shaken. But that is where and when we are finally in a place to actually learn what God has to teach us about what is really wise.